Miracles in My Life by John N. Loughborough, Chapter 10, The Marian Rebellion. In May 1865, the General Conference Council on the Distribution of Labor decided that I go with Elder and Mrs. White in some meetings in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa, and then labor among the churches in Iowa. At the time of our conference in Battle Creek, we were rejoicing in the fact that the 4 years of terrible civil war were over, and that now the coast was clear for a rapid advancement of the third angel's message. Little did we think that right in our midst, at the time of the conference, there were those on the ground who were gathering material with which to start another rebellion in the ranks of Seventh-day Adventists. At this conference were two or three brethren, accompanied by their wives, who were not in the truth. They were dressed in worldly fashion and wore jewelry. Here were also Elder Snook and Brinkenhoff from Iowa, who had already secretly been sowing seeds of discord in their conference. Then, without taking pains to learn who the ladies in worldly dress were, they returned with great stories of the pride of the Battle Creek Church, and how they saw them decorated with feathers and jewelry. They also trumped objections to the testimonies, and set out to cause division in our ranks in Iowa. Of all this we knew nothing until we reached Monroe, Wisconsin, June the 9th. There, Elder Ingraham showed Elder White a letter he received from Snook, which said, "Brother Ingraham, what do you think of striking out on the old plan of the independence of the churches?" In this, Elder White at once spotted rebellion and throwing off conference organization. When we reached Pilot Grove, where a spring session of the Iowa Conference was to be held, we learned that Snook and Brinkenhoff were teaching that the message would go forward as soon as it was rid of Sister White's testimonies. When we met in conference with our people at Pilot Grove, Elder White proposed that before entering upon any business, there be an investigation of the charges made by Snook and Brinkenhoff. They elected me chairman of that meeting, and we devoted a full day, June 30th, to the problem. The two men stated their objections, and either Elder or Mrs. White made reply. At 5 p.m., both men admitted that their objections were fully answered and that they had no more. A day or so later, I saw each of them, separately, hand to Elder White written confessions of their wrong course. Then on Sunday, before a large audience of outside parties, Snook said that he had been serving the devil in his opposition to the Whites. But after a few days, B.F. Snook's objections revived. He began to communicate with Brinkenhoff, and that ended his labors in our ranks, and they were again on their scheme of independence of the churches. However, this did not assume its final fighting for several months. Meanwhile, I labored with the Iowa churches. With reluctance, I parted from Elder White, but duty called to different fields, and so our journeyings together, which had been of great encouragement to me, came to a close. July 17, I left Marion for Walken, and in passing over the railroad in Dubuque, I witnessed some of the ravages of the Wapsconian River, which had risen 12 to 15 feet during the continuous rains. Large fields of corn and splendid gardens in the valleys had been swept away. Nearly every railroad bridge west of Dubuque was carried away. And when the water fell to its usual depth, old and safe fords had been gullied out to the extent that quite a number of teams and persons were drowned in the new gulfs. On Friday, July 28, Elder George Butler took Elder Brinkenhoff and me in his carriage to West Union. When we came to Claremont, we found the bridge over Turkey River gone and the fords impassable. The only means of crossing was in small rowboats. It was only 2 hours from the time of our next meeting, and it was 7 miles from the opposite side of the stream. Since it was 20 miles to the nearest bridge, we decided to cross in the skiff. Our baggage, the harness, and wagon seats were first taken across. Then the wagon was drawn astride a skiff with the wheels in the water. One man got into the boat to keep the wagon balanced. Another skiff with two men in it was rowed out, one man holding onto the tongue of our wagon and the other rowing with all of his might up the stream. Next, they swam the horses over one at a time. At last, with some trembling, we entered the skiff, and we were soon on the other shore. On August 8th, I traveled by stage 35 miles over very bad roads to Blairstown, where I found I must remain till morning before I could take the train. Here I had no place to stay but a small country tavern nearly filled with drunken hog drivers. They caroused all night and had 3 regular fist fights before midnight. I got no rest to speak of that night. The next morning I took the train 75 miles to Nevada. Here I found no food fit for a human being to eat, but did the best I could, then started for Fort Des Moines by stage 35 miles. The roads were in such a terrible state that it took 5 hours to cover the first 10 miles of the journey. At the time of our labors in Iowa, both Elder White and I were laboring beyond our better judgment. On the morning of August 24th, I stepped off the train at Eddyville, expecting to go with Brother Kaufman a few miles out to preach a funeral sermon for a sister who had been buried a few days before. The brother handed me a telegram which read, "Elder White paralyzed. Come to Battle Creek immediately." The conductor held the train for me to secure my ticket, and I went on to Battle Creek. When I arrived there and laid off my active labor, my brain was so congested that I could not bear the jar of walking except on tiptoes. In Battle Creek, I met Dr. Lay, a devoted church member who had visited Jackson's Water Cure in Dansville, New York, that he might learn their methods. After Elder White's stroke, he thought it best for the elder to go to Dansville for treatment, and on looking over my case, decided that I, too, needed water treatment and rest. So, on September 14, the Whites and I, accompanied by Dr. Lay, started for the home on the hillside at Danville, where we stayed until December 7. After 6 weeks, I recovered from the brain congestion, but remained with the Whites, taking them and others out for rides with a borrowed team and carriage. On December 7, we went to Rochester and were courteously entertained in the home of Bradley Lamson until January 1, 1866, when Elder White and family returned to Battle Creek. For 3 weeks, Elders Andrews, Elder and Mrs. Horton, and others met with us daily at Lamson's to pray for Elder White. On Christmas Day, the Rochester Church observed a fast, with 3 meetings in the city during the day. Then we met again in the evening at Lamson's to pray with Elder White. It was a powerful season. In the midst of it, Sister White had a vision, and Elder White was greatly blessed. In relating the vision, Sister White said, "Satan's purpose was to destroy my husband and bring him down to the grave. Through these earnest prayers, his power has been broken." By the time of my return to Battle Creek in the spring of 1866, Snook and Brinkerhoff had drawn off 45 of the 60 members of the Marian Church. They also gave energy to the Messenger and Hope of Israel parties and were zealously fighting the testimonies of Sister White. They started a paper called The Advent and Sabbath Advocate. But before many months had passed, both men dropped interest in the Advocate and gave up the Sabbath. Brother Starr of Iowa told me that the day he was baptized, Brinkerhoff was present and met him as he came up out of the water. Shaking hands with him, he said, "I'm glad to see you take your stand with this people. They have the truth, and I'm sorry I ever left them. It's too late for me to rejoin them. I am a lost man." The Advocate, however, was continued by a man named William Long. But how could he be a leader of a flock without an organization? They chose the name Church of God and soon organized churches and conferences and finally a general conference with headquarters at Stanbury, Missouri. From January until April 3, 1866, I remained in western New York, then returned to my home in Michigan and found Elder White still quite feeble. As the time for the General Conference session was drawing near, and Elder White unable to carry the burden as in former years, it was decided to appoint 4 days of fasting and prayer, May 9th through the 12th, for Elder White and for heavenly wisdom in the coming sessions of the General Conference, the Publishing Association, and the Michigan Conference, May 16th. Through the 21st. These meetings were held in the church and in a 50-foot tent. On the morning of May 19th, Sister White read to us for the first time the following testimony. Our people should have an institution of their own, under their own control, for the benefit of the diseased and suffering among us. Such an institution, rightly conducted, would be the means of bringing our views before many, whom it would be impossible for us to reach by the common course of advocating the truth. When the testimony was read to our people, the question arose, how can we, in our condition of limited means, obtain and control a health institution? Elder White was in critical health, so the matter seemed to fall upon the Michigan Conference Committee, of which I was president. After agreeing to proceed in faith, I drew up a subscription paper and went first to J.P. Kellogg, who in bold print pledged $500. In a few days, we had secured the residence of Judge Graves with 9 acres of land for $6,000. This is where the Battle Creek Sanitarium now stands, a 2-story building with 2 rooms above and 2 below for treatment rooms and water tank was erected. On September the 5th, 1866, the institution was formally opened for patients, having doctors Lay and Byington as physicians, 2 helpers, and 1 patient, being less than 4 months from the time the subject was first mentioned to our people. In August, we began the publication of a 16-page monthly journal, The Health Reformer. When we began to receive payments for shares in the enterprise, it became necessary to form a legal organization. So, I counseled with lawyers Dibble and Rhine. They told us there was no law for our case except the law for mining and manufacturing corporations, and such law provided for payment of dividends to stockholders. Thinking we must follow the law, we provided for a dividend of net earnings. When our first report was made in the spring of 1867, Sister White at once said, "This is not the course we are to take in managing our health institutions. The light given me is that the earnings of the institution should go to the building up of the institution and for charity work for the needy afflicted." Having received this additional light, we moved to remedy the matters and requested all who could to donate their profits to the institution. To this, they readily assented. At the General Conference of 1866, it was decided that some member of the General Conference Committee should attend the state conferences of the Central and Western States, and that Elders A.C. and D.T. Bordeaux should labor in the West, especially in Iowa. So, on June the 5th, in company with the Bordeaux brothers, I left for the Iowa State Conference at Pilot Grove. From there, I went to Illinois and Wisconsin. Then I returned to Battle Creek, but on the way held meetings with a little company of 12 members in the great city of Chicago. Since most medical works are large and expensive, it was decided that a small book should be prepared, compiled from the larger works, containing those things essential to aid the common reader in line with the testimony given us. The director of the Health Reform Institute requested me to prepare the manuscript with the understanding that he would carefully examine and criticize it. In between state conferences and various board meetings, it took 1 year to complete it. It was entitled Home Handbook of Health and totaled 228 pages. An edition of 3,000 was printed, bound in cloth, and sold for 75 cents a copy. On June 24, 1867, after the birth of a daughter, my wife was taken with a congestive chill, and within an hour from the birth of the child, she was dead. Thus suddenly, I was separated from her to whom I had been happily united for 16.5 years. So I was left with a 3-year-old son and a helpless babe. Brother and sister Myron Cornell kindly cared for little Mary for 1 year, and my brother and his family came from New York, occupied my house, and cared for my boy. Footnote: The Obituary of Mary Loughborough from the Review of July 2, 1867. It says, Mary J. Walker was born in Troy, New York, June 17, 1832. She was bereft of her father when but a few days old. A widowed mother still survives. She experienced religion under the labors of Elder E. R. Pinney of Rochester, New York, in 1849, who also now rests in hope. She was married to Elder J. N. Loughborough in 1851, by whom she had 5 children, 2 of them still living. With her husband, she embraced the truth of the third angel's message under the labors of Elder J. N. Andrews in Rochester, New York, September 1852. She traveled with her husband in most of the states where there are Sabbath keepers, and is the Sister L referred to in Spiritual Gifts, Volume 2, page 220. She died at the age of 35 years and 7 days. An injury received by a fall some 2 weeks since was probably the immediate cause of her death. On the day of her decease, she gave birth to 2 daughters, one of them, as it is supposed from the cause above mentioned, being dead. On the occasion of the funeral, the 26th institution, Brother Hutchins spoke from 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 14. So we left her in Oak Hill Cemetery, a new treasure committed to the tomb, there to slumber with her little one, sweetly pillowed on her arm, till the life-giver shall return to rescue his jewels from the dominion of the enemy.